If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game with me, Alison, the Iron Lady Rudd. No Gab this week, but we have a fine lineup to keep you entertained for the next 40 minutes or so. In the studio with me, Rory Smith and Tony Cascarino. And from his cute little cottage in the northeast, George Culkin. Later on, we're going to focus on a potential changing of the guard in the Premier League and review Sunderland's triumph over Newcastle. But we'll start with the FA Cup semi-finals. First up, one of the most entertaining games of the season, I think, Manchester City's defeat of Chelsea at Wembley. Rory, you gave Yaya Toure the highest marks in your lovely assessment of the players. But I thought Yaya was the difference between the teams.
Yeah, I think...
You agree, obviously.
Yeah, if you put... it's not my own thought, so I shouldn't claim it, but if you put Yaya and Gareth Barry, the admittedly sort of pedestrian Gareth Barry, in Chelsea's midfield instead of Ramirez, who can't control the football, and John Obi Mikel, who can't pass one, then I think Chelsea win that game. That was the difference between the teams, that Yaya, I don't think he's not been as good this season as he was at the tail end of last season, Yaya, but he's such a driving force in midfield that teams can't live with him. And he was, certainly for the first hour yesterday, by some considerable distance, the best player on the pitch.
Tony, were you impressed?
Absolutely. I mean, it was a Patrick Vieira type of performance, wasn't it? What we all loved and admired about him, driving the team forward. Chelsea couldn't handle it. And the midfield and just everything that came at them come from him. You know, he's a huge guy. I mean, he's a big unit and he just comes at you with pace and power. He drives forward and he was the real difference. And, you know, I got to say it, one of my favourite players is Silva, and Man City didn't look like they missed him. Yeah. By it because of Yaya Toure, because of his performance, and that typified the result for me was the difference was him.
By the same token, Tony, if Juan Mata, who I think is the heartbeat of the Chelsea side, had been tick-tocking properly, it might have been a different story.
Yeah, it didn't quite happen for him. Look, he's been superb all season. And do you know what? Football, a good number of years ago, every club was looking for players like Patrick Vieira, Yaya Toure, big, powerful guys that use their athleticism and their power to drive, literally break down the opposition. And Juan Mata and players of his ilk, and many teams, and Barcelona are the greatest example, where they went for a smaller, nimble, more agile, gifted, technically superb, and goals galore. That's what Mata gave Chelsea. And I just got that funny feeling yesterday. Maybe there's going to be a bit of return of big, powerful midfielders, because every club or every child's game I went and watched over the course of a season, I see so many scouts looking for big, powerful midfielders because they just saw that as the dominating figure.
But that was the problem, wasn't it? That Vieira was like Toure. It's not just that he's big and tall and rangy and powerful.
Gifted as well.
He was incredibly technically gifted, and so is Toure. That's the thing that kind of stands out with Yaya.
And Mata was lost, really.
Well, I think
him and the others. I don't want to just point out Mata because he didn't really get into the game. But the whole of the Chelsea midfield was seemingly dominated by one particular guy.
Well, Hazard came into it the last half hour when City brought on about seven central defenders and sat back about 10 yards. But the thing with Chelsea, they just looked absolutely knackered. Mata isn't exactly sort of I'm not saying he's not fit, but he's not kind of an athletic got that sort of slender build. He's sort of a little bit short, a little bit squat. He's not desperately quick, but they all look just completely exhausted.
Really? I'm interested you say that, because they ought to look knackered, but I thought in the second half they were firing.
When City sat back an extra 10 yards, Hazard, they got Hazard into the game. Oster did nothing. I liked Oster. I think he's come on a lot. Oster, I think he's done, and Tony agrees, I think, that he's going to be a tremendous player. Matt is obviously a world-class footballer. But they all looked shattered. And it's no surprise. I mean, they landed at 3 a.m. from Moscow on Friday. So they had sort of 60 hours to prepare for the game. A lot of them didn't play, but they all travelled, which I think does a lot of damage. And they've played 15 more games than City this season. City looked like they had more energy. I agree with you, they came into it, but that's more adrenaline, and that might actually kind of.
And they slightly went for it. We've put in Torres down, you know, down the more central, closer to Demba Ba. There was a bit of a style, and they went back to front much more quicker, where they tried to compete with City in the opening hour of the game by going through the midfield, like Rory said. Ramirez kept getting it, giving it away. Mikel was just anonymous to me. I'd never quite got what everybody saw in Mikel. But I think with that, I think Mata suffered because he's had better partners in there and more help, and didn't think they gave it to him.
I feel a bit like we're leaving George out of this, but just final thing on Chelsea. They don't have a problem this summer, whoever is manager, regardless of, it's obviously not going to be Guardiola, but whether it's Pellegrini or Mourinho or whoever, if Abramovich does what he normally wants to do, which is sign loads of attacking players because he thinks that will win him games, they will have another season like this season, because what they need is possibly one fullback, probably another central defender, and at least two proper midfielders. Tony said in the paper today that the defence is the problem. I respectfully disagree and think the actual problem is the defensive midfield, in that they don't have one.
Oh, I agree with you, Rory, because I was hoping we might solve the mystery of Mikel today, because I think he's really holds Chelsea back. And I think a myth has grown up, because when they were at Old Trafford in the FA Cup and Mikel came on, and then they drew 2-2 after being 2-0 down, everyone said what a tactical genius Rafa is. He's brought Mikel on, it's allowed the team to go forward. I think what happens is when Mikel's on, they all feel they have to put in extra energy because they're a 10-man team suddenly. I don't, George, do you have any theories on what Mikel offers the team?
Nothing earth-shattering, but I mean, I mean, I sort of see that. I mean, I see it in the teams that I watch up here as well. You have players in certain positions who seem to offer something. I don't quite get it with Mikel either. You know, it's that kind of water carrier role, isn't it? But you know, I think we expect more from that from players now. There has to be, and it's not just about breaking play up; it's about doing something with the ball too. And I don't quite see it with him.
But he doesn't even break play up. He can't tackle.
He doesn't move. That's the.
He just sort of stands there. He just, yeah, he does. He doesn't do.
He makes
anything.
He makes Chelsea very ponderous. He makes the weight, because when he takes the ball from centre halves, he looks to go forward. It's all done at a very slow pace. It's quite easy passing. It's not eye catching. He doesn't score goals. He gets loads of bookings. You know, I don't think he's a very creative player. He's never going to see Mikel open the back four up with a threading pass. He just doesn't do so many things. He does keep it quite well, but not much more.
Let's deal with the penalty that wasn't given. Anyone going to disagree that it should have been a penalty?
Hang on, I'm confused.
Torres having his hair, having his shirt taken off by company.
It was a penalty. That's what we think, isn't it? We think it was a penalty.
Okay. And the lunge by Aguero, quite a lot said about by David Lewis on this. First of all, he demands an apology, then he says he forgives him. It was an aberration. He's not regarded as a dirty player, is he, Tony?
No, but it was a really poor challenge. Yeah. That's a deliberate attempt to hurt somebody. I think you cannot come away from that. When you start lifting your feet and your feet are in an action of literally off the ground, and 2 feet, you can see the thighs literally being bent, and his feet come down onto Luiz. I just thought it was a really bad challenge. There was a couple of incidents during the game, wasn't there? A couple of nasty things happened in the game. Nothing that crossed the line, but that was the thing that I think a lot of players will look at and thought, you deliberately really tried to hurt him there.
I don't get this, he's not that sort of player thing. I mean, obviously it's a slight exaggeration, but like most people who kill people wouldn't describe themselves as that kind of person. Do you know? It doesn't matter. If he does it, then he's done it.
Yes, but if we saw murderers on CCTV in their kitchen week in, week out, we would generally form an opinion, yeah, he's a hothead, he might hit his wife over the head with a saucepan.
Confirmation.
If you slow the action replays down of the man with the saucepan hitting his wife on the head, it would look much worse than it would necessarily do in real life.
Right, well, Man City will play the mighty Wigan in the FA Cup final. This is a bit indulgent because I've sort of slowly fallen in love with Sean Maloney this season. He's Wigan's player of the season, isn't he, Tony?
Well, me and Rory have done so much. Well, I think we've probably had 10 conversations, this going back from last year. Well, I personally thought that he single-handedly dragged Wigan out of the mire and got results. He is one of them players you just look at and think, why is a top four club not took him? Now, I know he come from Scotland and he had a bit of a difficult time with Aston Villa, and Martin O'Neill never quite found his feet.
You've answered your own question there, haven't you?
Yeah, so, well, I have, but I've watched a player for 18 months. I think he's been absolutely one of the best players I've seen in the last 18 months. And he's a player that, to me, easily could play for a top four team. Easily. Now, whether he's matured, grown up, not done the things off the field that he might have done before, or for whatever reason, I'm seeing a really clever player. I said to Rory, I said, when Fergie got cleverly back from Manchester United from Wigan, I remember chatting and saying, I'll tell you what, how we couldn't see that Maloney's a better player than Cleverly, I don't know. And I know he was a Man U player on loan, but I actually bought that at the time, and I think he's a player that easily could go on.
I think it's quite interesting that maybe you might have a love rival for Sean Maloney, Alison. I think Cass might be fighting you for his
well,
affections.
We don't get many things right in life, do you? You get one, well, you've got to go for it.
Is it a love triangle?
I tell you, I really like Maloney, but the one with Wigan that I find it stunning. I know that they want a lot of money for him, and that's maybe put teams off. What a player McCarthy is!
Yeah.
What a player! Just so calm and so kind of technically excellent. His positioning is brilliant. He reads the game well, tackles well. He does everything John Obi Mikel can't. Won't get overrun, I wouldn't have thought, by Torre in the same way in the final. But what just a fantastic footballer.
And don't be surprised with Lab McManaman as well, the kid that's just come in. He's really looking a player as well.
Yeah. The two things actually quite interesting, because McCarthy went down from Hamilton to Wigan. I think Liverpool were in for him, and possibly Everton, and he decided to go to Wigan because he wanted to play, which is something that all young players could learn from. Don't go to the big club and sit on the bench, it's pointless.
Yeah.
Go to Wigan, take your chances, believe in your ability. McManaman is I can't remember which academy he was at, but Wigan had got this policy of getting 18 to 22 year olds from all the clubs around them and bringing the ones that the other academies have rejected through, and McManaman's the first kind of success they've had with that. And it's great to see that the game had kind of maybe given up on McManaman a little bit. He'd obviously been determined not to be good enough, and now he's getting his chance.
Right, Rory, you've just described a top four team. How come Wigan might go down?
Because the other nine players aren't very good.
That's not true though, is it?
Because Gary,
you should be answering.
Does Gary Caldwell's in their squad?
Rory, they won't go down.
You see,
that's the answer.
I'm worried. You love Sean Maloney. I genuinely love Roberto Martinez, in that I spent quite a lot of time outside his house just watching him. And because I think he's wonderful.
We can give his address, can't we?
We can.
I know where he lives.
I think we've all got his address written on our hearts. But I am worried about them, because I think Sunderland's win at Newcastle kind of chucks them back into it. At some point, they'll look.
We've agreed. There are elements to Wigan we all love, whether it's the manager or the individual players. But why? Why are they in the position they're in? They have players we have just gushed over. So why?
Because they start slowly. Do they always sell someone who's important in the summer? Do they've got a really small squad? And because Martinez's open style runs risks.
Okay, and Martinez said after the final, in his beautiful little way, he thinks preparation for the FA Cup final will assist their relegation battle. And George,
it can do. Yeah, no, I mean, it can do. We've seen it before. You've got momentum somewhere. That momentum can sort of, you know, can infiltrate in other areas too. But we've seen it go the other way around. Saw Norwich win the League Cup and go down doesn't necessarily mean that. And you know, the point is that because they've been playing these cup games, they are in the bottom three, and once you're in the bottom three, you know, I think it kind of calcifies that difficulty. It becomes an emotional thing, and it can be more difficult to get out.
And of course, you meant that Birmingham won the League Cup and went down, didn't you, really, George?
No, I meant Norwich, but Birmingham done the same thing since then. Yeah,
when did Norwich do that, George? We're all looking really blank.
Did you mean
it was 1984 or 1985, wasn't it, when they played Sunderland and they both went down?
Well done, George. I have no idea
that's
if that's
amazing.
True or not.
Milk cup.
That's amazing. Andy used the word calcifies in a sentence. What?
Milk calcification.
That is an incredible display of power from Tolkien.
Just on one thing, and we're talking about, you've mentioned Wigan, and you know, we're talking about they could go down and win the cup. It wouldn't surprise me. They go to Man City this week. And Man City have just played Man United and they've played Chelsea in the semi-final of the Cup. Two big, big games for them. And second place is pretty much tied up, isn't it? They'll stay in the Champions League. It wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility that Wigan could go there and get a result. How many times have we seen teams have a really tough week, hard games like Chelsea we've touched on, and then suddenly come up against someone like Wigan and they get beat?
George, can Wigan win the Cup?
Yeah, of course they can, but they won't.
Rory?
I agree with George.
No, I think as much as I said they'd win at Man City, they could do, or could do, I think on a cup final day, I think City have got too much class.
Although, having said that, I do agree with George, but Wigan can beat big teams, and if they play and City, if City are overconfident, we saw City against Stoke two years ago. Yeah, they only just edged that against Stoke because the pressure of being the massive favourites obviously got to them a little bit, and Stoke were massively up for the biggest game of their careers or whatever. It's not a foregone conclusion. It's not. If it had been City Millwall, you'd be saying, right, this is, you know, how many can Millwall avoid conceding? Wigan can beat big sides.
And you've just reminded me that Millwall were involved at the weekend. Do we have sympathy for their image problem? The standard thing now said is when there's an issue with the Millwall fans, people say, oh, I do feel sorry for the, you know, the people in charge of the club. They've tried so hard to change the image. Tony, is that the story?
It doesn't
matter what they do, the fans can't help themselves.
Well, the club have done unbelievable strides. I mean, look, I followed the club as a kid. It was always, although Liverpool was my real love, I went and watched Millwall because I lived around the area. I know lots of Millwall fans. It's an amazing club in many ways. They have done everything in their power to try and stop this problem with Millwall fans. And I'm saying to Rory this, that it's quite incredible. Everyone made a big thing about the ticket allocation that, you know, Wigan couldn't sell it out, yet Millwall done in days. Millwall get half the crowds of Wigan, half of South London. I know, I lived in the area. There's so many Millwall fans within the area, and yet Charlton get bigger crowds and nearly double what Millwall get, and so do Crystal Palace get far bigger crowds than Millwall, and yet most of South London is Millwall fans. The problem that Millwall has as a football club, they have so many fans that don't go, but when they have a big opportunity, like a player final or an FA Cup semi-final, they come from the woodwork, and they are there, and there is a lot of problems with the outside Millwall fans, the fans that don't come too often. And I was with some fans Saturday night because I was at a 50th, and a load of them went to the game, and they said all the troubles about two groups, one from Bermondsey and one from Peckham, started fighting each other. Rival gangs within areas of the Millwall, South London area, where they just decided they'd have a tear-up. And they started fighting themselves. They then started fighting policemen that got involved. And this is the problem for Millwall Club, because they sold their tickets, or some amount of tickets, you could go to the ground and buy. You know, they'd sold their allocation, and they'd done it done it really quickly. And yet, This type of thing will happen, and I know that I feel sympathy with the club, because I know the club are embarrassed by it. I know lots of Millwall fans are embarrassed by it, because unfortunately for Millwall as a club, there's pride in a good number of Millwall fans of being thugs. They seem to have pride in it, and these type of guys hardly ever go. There hasn't been a problem at Millwall Football Stadium for quite a long time.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot of police protection, but every time there's an occasion where they've got to go somewhere, or, you know, there's a big match moment, these people come out the woodwork. And I think that's the bigger problem for the club, is trying to stop these people that only come now and again.
Do we know how to solve that, Rory?
Well, I suppose not putting tickets on general sale, maybe. I mean, I don't know if there is, and yeah, it's difficult. If you could, I suppose, introduce some sort of scheme where you have to present an ID.
They had a members' scheme.
They did have that. Theo Profetis introduced it, didn't they? I don't know whether it's still in place. There are measures you can take, but I think, to be honest, I think Tony's right, that if you've got loads and loads of people who want to go and make trouble,
they sold 34,000 tickets. They get 10,000. Watch them every other week. That's a big crowd. 10,000. It's like this is a part of the problem.
What I would say is that, and I think that's, there was this initial the Millwall's reaction, and I think the club deserve a huge amount of credit for what they've done. I'm slightly uneasy with the way that Kenny Jackett, who I think is a wonderful proper football man, Kenny Jackett, everyone speaks really highly of him, the way that he will not condemn them straight away. I understand he's in an awkward position, but he didn't, on Saturday night, he didn't come out and condemn them. He said he hadn't seen the fighting. He must have really not been watching, because everyone else could see the fighting, as there's pictures of the players watching the fighting. Kenny Jack comes out and says, well, I didn't see it, so I don't want to condemn it. He's still not condemned it. And I understand that he's in a difficult position because he has to be kind of responsible to the club, but also doesn't want to antagonise the thuggish element. But the press officer, I think, came out and said that maybe it was sort of West Ham fans infiltrating the home end, which is the default setting of it's not our fault. It is a huge problem for Millwall, but I don't know, I'm slightly uneasy that they maybe don't confront it quite as they should.
To be fair to Kenny, after the Luton game at Luton in the FA Cup, there was a bit of trouble, and it did turn out that all the arrests were West Ham fans. The West Ham fans had travelled to Luton in order to cause trouble outside the ground in the station.
But you shouldn't. That's fine. But you shouldn't be saying
point,
that straight away.
It's a slightly kind of media related point as opposed to a football point. But it's quite interesting the way these things work. Obviously, you know, those pictures from the weekend were pretty horrible. But it then puts everybody on a kind of setting that means that. I mean, what happened at outside Newcastle Stadium yesterday also looked really ugly, but 20 or 30 arrests outside a football stadium in the northeast isn't actually that unusual. And I'm absolutely not condoning that. It's just that suddenly, because there were pictures of it and because of what happened at Millwall on the weekend, there's this huge prominence and it's football's weekend of shame. I'm not entirely sure that's the reality of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the other thing I think that's important in terms of Millwall is that it was dressed up as this return to the bad old days. There were not 50 or 60 people fighting in the bad old days. That was a scuffle. What used to happen was a lot worse. And in a kind of slightly twisted sense, it maybe shows how far the game has come, that is now considered dreadful, when in reality 1983, that's probably quite a lot, that's probably a decent afternoon for the police.
And in some way as well, if you look at it, these people are going to be caught because their images are there for everybody to see, and it's actually going to be a moment where even fans who are considering, you know, that there's going to be a problem at a stadium, they might think again because all these images have been shown everywhere, so that all these people are going to get found and be caught. I mean, the guy with the Millwall fan with a policeman's hat on, I mean, it's a full page, you know, everyone's going to know him. He's going to be famous for 15 minutes as Andy Warhol, and everybody is, but these people are going to get arrested.
Right, brilliant podcast puts pleasant spin on riot. The Tynemouir Derby. George, is that the best one you've covered for the Times?
No, I wouldn't say it was the best. It was certainly up. It was, I mean, Newcastle didn't turn up, so I can't say it was one of the best. It was certainly one of the most remarkable, and certainly the most remarkable since the 5-1 Newcastle victory, and completely sort of counter to all expectations, even amongst, you know, some of the fans that I know. There was really, the thinking was that they would go there and that they would lose.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So it was a pretty special day for them. They played really, really well. And kind of Di Canio got them doing exactly what the club wanted him to do, which was, you know, to get kind of players to overachieve. And, you know, Newcastle, by the same token, underachieved. They were very poor.
How do you reckon Di Canio's done it? Is it purely because he's passionate, or has he got some sort of tactical masterstroke he's been pulling?
Well, I think it's one of those footballing things where a new manager comes in, and any new manager will get some sort of result, it will have some sort of effect, because players are intrinsically sort of selfish. They have a new man to impress, and they're thinking about their sort of career. So, you know, that gives a lift. That would only go so far if there wasn't something behind it. Obviously, it's very early in terms of sort of determining exactly what he's doing on the training ground or not. But he's working with them individually, as well as sort of collectively. And, you know, it was interesting to see someone like Adam Johnson, who had a kind of really awful season. You know, he was expected to be a player that was going to, you know, I mean, he was sort of a statement signing by Sunderland, I mean, in the sense of what it meant to them as opposed to what it means to the rest of the country. It was, you know, he was the person that was kind of lifting people's heads in the summer, and he's been awful. That was arguably his best performance this season, and it's interesting to see that sort of Di Canio's had a had some kind of effect on him. And all the way through the game, he was Di Canio was talking to him and shouting at him, you know, and there was a big effect.
I was at George. I remember chatting to Noel Quinn, and he was telling me about Roy Keane's greatest moment. He said when he brought in three players, they went and played at Barnsley, and you'll remember it well. And he dropped the three for making the bus late, and they got there, and he said, and they won 2-0. And he said, and Keane could not have had a more, you know, iconic moment from the fans' point of view. And I said, I'm watching it. I'm sent to a pal on Saturday. I'm watching the game, and I'm like, yesterday. And what an impact that Di Canio has made with the fans already. You know, it's like it's up there whether he's a god already after, what, two games, one at Chelsea and one against Sunderland.
The Keane comparison is kind of quite a good one because, I mean, in terms of sort of lack of experience and so on and so forth. But also, I mean, arguably for the wrong reasons when he initially came in at Sunderland, but he did kind of light the blue touch paper beneath the club, beneath the city. He's given it a bit of a shock and sort of lifted people. You know, that sort of passion that he showed on the touchline yesterday.
George, how's that been received, the celebration of the goals? How's that been received?
Well, I mean, from Sunderland's perspective, obviously very well. From the Newcastle perspective, I guess it would be kind of less so, but then by the same token, it's not as if, you know, it's not as if Alan Pardew doesn't do sort of similar, you know, similar things. I don't think it was seen as inflammatory because he was sort of doing it in front of, it's sort of in the direction of Sunderland fans as opposed to sort of doing it to Newcastle punters.
But do you not think, in a way, because of the fury over his appointment, I feel he had to behave in that sort of exhibitionist manner to make us sort of fall back in love with him? Do you see what I mean? We now know. It's as if by behaving like that on the touchline. I mean, you know, he's zoomed to number one in the charts of managers we're all going to want to watch, hasn't he? It's another level of celebration and passion and just being so visible about it. I do feel it's allowed us to draw a line under the whole is he a fascist or not debate and move to the, well, he's just a crazy, amazing guy.
I think it's difficult to quantify in those terms. I mean, I think, but you know, there are still a lot of people, you know, sort of very, you know, sort of decent Sunderland fans for a long time who are still appalled by the fact that he's been appointed. They will get, you know, they'll get drowned out probably by the majority of fans who want to come to the stadium, who want to see their team stay up, and but I do think that what he has done is. You know, in the same way as Keane did, it's his passion that's then reflected back onto them, and it's helped a club and it's helped a team and it's helped a city to sort of lift its head a little bit at precisely the time that they need it. I mean, you have to remember that if you've been a Sunderland fan, even while they've had this, you know, very long unbroken stretch in the Premier League, I mean, very long in their own context of their own history, there's been long, long stretches in seasons where it's been pretty miserable for them, and they haven't quite made the leap that they expected to do, and it's very easy for them to fall back onto that kind of depression and misery that sort of saw them get relegated those two times with, you know, record low point hauls. I mean, that's very much in their history, so they do need this jolt, and he's certainly given them that jolt.
George, does this pull Newcastle back into the relegation battle?
Well, they're 13th, aren't they? So there's a gap in terms of teams, and it's been a difficult season for Newcastle anyway, what with the Europa League. That's now gone, and it looks pretty stark for them now, and this, you know, results like this do linger.
That must have been a factor as well, though. The as it was with Chelsea, playing on Thursday night, Sunderland have had a free week. That must affect. I know you ask players about it, and George will have done this as well. You ask players about it, they'll go, no, it's fine. You know, we're a big squad, we can cope, we're all professionals. But it must make a difference. Even the emotional tiredness of having kind of come that close to having that great comeback against Benfica to then finding themselves 1-1, you're out, and suddenly Sunderland are in your face and Paolo Di Canio sliding along the touchline.
I just think in sport, and I've said this on numerous occasions, that the edge, the difference, and it's only small and it can be taken away by, like you said, it's not always that reason, but if you don't ever have that edge in sport, you're just not the same, whether it's a team or an individual. You can be beaten, you can be vulnerable.
But George, you did say at the start of your assessment of the derby that Newcastle didn't turn up. I mean, there can only be one excuse for that, and that is that they were jaded after the match against Benfica.
Yeah, I mean, does that excuse them for putting in arguably their worst performance at home? I'm not sure it does. I think there's more, you know,
Was it really their worst performance? It didn't look that bad. I know they lost 3-0, but they didn't. I mean, they had some chances.
They did have some chances. You know, Cisse had a perfectly decent goal ruled out for offside, but I don't think anybody was making a claim for injustice. I mean, normally, you know, that would have made the score 1-1. You know, so it was quite a crucial moment. But then afterwards, you know, there was no sense that anybody from Newcastle, either, you know, as part of the club or supporters, were kind of claiming that as a sort of huge injustice. I mean, it just didn't feel like that at all. I mean, even as a journalist reporting on Europe, you know how much it takes it out of you, either travelling or doing the work or being part of it all. No. But I suppose what I mean is that you can feel that the travelling does make you more tired, and that, I mean, not that Newcastle were away from home last week. I mean, I definitely think that's the case. And if you've had injuries and your squad's been stretched anyway, then obviously it's gonna make a difference. I don't think that's a good enough excuse for the lack of impetus that Newcastle had, for the lack of imagination. You know, they looked so ponderous on the ball. I thought that was the sort of thing that kind of really surprised me, was that it looked like every single player needed 3 seconds on the ball. There was no speed of thought. There was kind of no movement. And you know, I think that's a big deal. I mean, I think that's a big deal in Northeast terms, and it's one of those things that sort of takes a while to forget about and put right.
People get more tired in the Northeast.
Famously, and I was going to say that part of the reason that George might find his European trip so exhausting is the nights out. I don't think the players have the same problem.
That is incredibly unprofessional of you, Rory.
So, quick poll. Who thinks Di Canio will keep Sunderland up? Yes, I do. Tony?
Really don't know, honestly.
You've got to say yes or no. You've got to say yes or no.
It's going to be touch and go, and I'll still go that Sunderland will go.
They're going down? Ooh.
I think he might keep them up, but not... I think they'll stay up, but I don't know if it'll be because of Di Canio. I think they might stay up because of the failings of others.
George?
Before yesterday, I'd have said going down. Now I would say going up. They've still got to play Stoke and Southampton. I think they'll do it now.
Good. Right. Let's move to our debate. With Everton visiting... This is difficult to say because I don't know when you're listening to this, everybody. So, Everton, they're visiting the Emirates on Tuesday, which might be tomorrow or it might be tonight. So... there's a battle on there, which is the most intriguing. Arsenal's desire to finish higher than Spurs, or vice versa, or Everton's desire to finish above Liverpool, and vice versa. Rory, which of those two lovely little side issues, maybe, but they've become the big ones at the moment, intrigue you the most?
Probably Arsenal and Spurs, just Everton finished above Liverpool last year, and I think it's fairly obvious that Everton are a better football team than Liverpool. So it would be, I mean, injustice is probably too much, but Everton deserve to finish above Liverpool because they've been better this season than Liverpool for all of the season. So,
and do Everton deserve a Champions League place?
I'd love it if Everton got in the Champions League. I don't think they will, but I think it would be fantastic. And the really interesting thing with Everton in the Champions League, I think as it stands, Moyes will leave this summer.
Regardless?
Well, no. I think if they got in the Champions League, he might. I suspect that's what he's waiting for to make his decision. I think if they end up even in the Europa League, I think he probably goes. Does he really? It's 10 years, and they've obviously hit a glass ceiling, Everton. If he can get them in the Champions League, that's a massive game changer. And there's no reason why they can't go to the Emirates and win Everton, because they're an incredibly difficult side to play. So I think that's... The situation they're in is really interesting, but Arsenal and Spurs is kind of the more significant one almost, because, well, I've said on this before, I think it'd be good for Arsenal not to finish in the top four. I think it's important that they don't finish in the top four.
There's obviously lots of interest in David Moyes from other clubs.
Where do you think he'd go then if they didn't
I've been told for quite a while that Chelsea have shown a real interest in thinking of going British, you know, because of not the guarantees of maybe what happens with Mourinho or whoever, that they really feel like a British type of manager. Not done that under Abramovich, you know, so he obviously, and apparently Abramovich is a big fan of a guy that's done amazingly well with very little.
He really likes Tony Hibbert, Abramovich. He's really impressed by the way Moyes has brought Hibbert through.
Would that still, you know, everyone has hit lists, don't they? Whether it's a player, you might go for a player, you'd have two, three choices of a particular player you want if you can't get the one you want. And I think it's the same with a manager. I think clubs look at managers and they go, I tell you what, if we can't get him, we go boom, 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 and they're in the frame. And I, for me, David Moyes not wanting to stay on and having maybe other goals, there has to be a lot of inquiries made to him and his agent.
But I suspect, Tony, if Chelsea really are thinking of Moyes, I think Moyes' list of what you must not do, how you must not interfere, will be even more strict than Mourinho's list of do not interfere.
I think that you're right. I do feel that. But when say if you were David Moyes and he's fought so hard, long and hard against, you know, clubs of far more backing than he's had, and he's been competitive and it's got a team like the same this year. I mean, you think that Hannah Shabey would be a centre forward for a team that could be, you know, this kid couldn't get in, he's in and out of the team all the time and wouldn't get in any top four team. And he's had players like Seamus Coleman and coming at right back, and he's had Hibbert, and he's had, you know, players. He's took three Man United rejects in Howard, Philip Neville, and the lad in midfield, Gibson. You know, they weren't regulars, and okay, Neville more so than the other two, but he still managed to get a team challenging so high. So there'll be clubs looking at him and thinking, just give him a chance. Maybe it is his chance. And what is he, nearly 50 now? I think it could be a possibility that he could easily be attracted to a very big club.
No manager with a brain would go to Chelsea in ordinary circumstances, but Moyes needs a shot at a big club. It's an imperfect big club because you have to accept that Abramovich will interfere, he'll sign the wrong players, that Emanalo will do whatever he can to protect his own position despite clearly being relatively inept. But Moyes probably has to take that risk because he's not going to get, say Ferguson retired this summer, which he's not going to, but say he did, Moyes isn't a contender for United because he's not done enough. He needs to take a chance. He's an imperfect candidate, so he needs an imperfect club.
This does contrast, we're gushing a little bit about Everton. It does contrast quite starkly with the fact we're not gushing about Liverpool. Rory, is it significant that Everton will finish above Liverpool for the second season running?
To an extent. They're less of a team than Everton. Everton have got a clear identity. Liverpool still look a bit confused, a little bit kind of uncertain.
Liverpool as a football club cannot be outside the very best. They're a club that's got a huge history. It's been pretty much accepted that there's an open top bus at Anfield now if they make top four, which I find incredible to where Liverpool were as a football club. I think it's been a real strange year for Rodgers because of the way the season started, the documentary and behind the scenes at Liverpool, and I weren't quite sure, you know, all these messages that were going out.
How big a mistake was that documentary, do you think?
For me, big, because I think you can get problems within your own dressing room. And then at the start of the season, he was leaving out all these big names, Enrique down in, that had all been bought for money, and a good few others that he'd done. And he's ended up having to go back to most of these. So I felt that you were asking for trouble within your own camp that you didn't need to do. That was the problem I had with it.
George,
isn't it interesting, Rory, that all of Kenny Dalglish and Damien Comolli's signings, with the exception of Andy Carroll, who obviously was shipped out on loan, have been the ones that Liverpool have turned to this season, and not Rodgers' signings?
I don't want to leave this debate without just picking you up, Rory, and why it's good for football that Arsenal don't make the top four.
It's not good for football. I think it's more... it probably is good for football. It's more interesting. And I think Spurs probably deserve it. I think they're a better team at their best. Spurs are a better team than Arsenal at their best. I think Arsenal need a jolt to the system. Theoretically, they have the money to cope with a season out of the Champions League. Fine, let's put that to the test. And the other thing is that I think it might wake Wenger up from his sort of reverie. The problem that Arsenal are going to have is that if they finish third or fourth, and they could even finish second if City start slipping up, Wenger will use it to say, this team is fine, look at what we've achieved. He does it every single year. They mess up at the start, they recover, and he says, we're moving in the right direction. They're not moving in the right direction, they are standing still, and they need a jolt to prove that to Wenger.
But it does allow them to keep signing decent players.
But the problem with Arsenal is they only sign decent players. They don't sign extraordinary players, which is what they need to get to the level where they're competing with United and City. They're a long way back. They need something. That's the flip side, that you wouldn't be able to get the top quality players. Although I think Arsenal's reputation is enough that maybe people would still join them.
See, if he thinks his team's going to be great, the only way of defining great in these teams is by looking at teams he had before. He signed great players. You know, whether it was Robert Perez, whether it was Thierry Henry, whether it's Patrick Vieira. You know, so you have to. All the great sides that we watch and teams that win leagues and have great players in them, whether it was Van Persie going to Man United, whether it's Aguero the year before or Tevez, they have great players. So you have to buy the very, very best or you cannot be competitive. You will be, like Rory said, you'll stand still. You'll be a team that can scrape over the line and there will always be question marks and everybody's waiting. Arsenal fans have been waiting for a good few years now, waiting for it to develop.
Arsenal are sort of in a similar position to Liverpool, obviously a much better position than Liverpool, but the problem is kind of the same, which is that you go through both of their first 11s and you sort of look at it and you think, well, you know, he's not bad, he's all right, you know, there's no sort of obvious weak point. It's not like you look at Arsenal and think, right, the right back is dreadful, get the world's best right back, get Dani Alves, and you're going to be challenging for a title. It's hard to see. They're all 7 out of 10 players. At Liverpool, they're maybe 6.5 out of 10 players. But the problem is that, as Tony says, they need a couple of 9 out of 10 players to compete with United and City. And Wenger doesn't see that.
And now we've left Podolski crying into his tea. Quick hit time. Tony Cascarino. Is the international break holiday time? Roy Hodgson fears too many clubs maybe think that is what it's for.
Yeah, I think slightly. And I also think before we blame the clubs and we blame managers and I look at players and I think sometimes players, and I know a good few international players who have see this as what it is that international football can be a bit of a hindrance for some of these. They're actually quite happy to not be involved and not travel or not go along. I think it's not just the managers. I think it's a lot of the players as well. I know quite a number of players who have pulled out of squads because they're not so keen and going to play for their country.
Bit of a theme developing today about people not liking travel. Any reasons for Stoke to be cheerful after their 2-0 defeat to United, Rory?
It was quite sunny. that United away kit's quite nice. It's the game's over, so they don't have to play United again. I'm worried about Stoke. Not worried, and that would imply that I care. But I think Stoke might be relegated this season from the Barclays Premier League to the Npower Championship because they're not very good at football, and they look like, I think teams have worked them out, and I think the players have stopped believing in Pulis's methods despite his naked showering.
I thought they played okay, actually. Have you seen Villa's run in, George? They've got Man United, then Sunderland, then Norwich, then Chelsea, then Wigan. Discuss.
It's a stinker. But the one thing they have got is a bit of momentum. I think they've won 3 of the last 5 games. They're unbeaten in four of five. There's reasons for optimism. And that, I mean, that is massively important at this time of the season. To go back to Stoke, I think they've won one game this year. So I think Villa have far more cause for optimism than Stoke do.
Big Sam is hopeful his contract will be sorted by the end of the week. Tony, has he won the fans over?
I think the answer's a definite yes, because Upton Park, you would certainly know if you hadn't won the fans over. They're a pretty ferocious bunch of fans down at Upton Park, and I think they have to appreciate that they were the team that come up with the other two. I think they've done the best. I think they've done really well, West Ham, so yeah.
Rory, why were Queen's Park Rangers unable to build on those consecutive wins over Southampton and Sunderland?
They'd say they were quite unlucky against Wigan, I think, not to get a victory there. I think there's a lack of, and Redknapp kind of alluded to this, I think they've got some decent players, QPR, but they've also got some really poor players, and there's also a lack of sort of cohesion to the squad. Someone just shoved loads of players in there. They're all on massive money. There's no kind of identity to them, and I think they're losing hope. I think losing Nick Duddison is probably it for QPR.
Mancini says teams don't try as hard against United. Does he have a point, George?
Well, I remember Alex Ferguson saying a few years ago that Man United have it more difficult because everybody raises their game against Man United. Now, I've just made that up, but it could be true. And the point is, and the point is, people raise their games against champions. People raise their games against good teams. So, do I think he's got a point? No, I don't.
And one for you, Alison Rudd, standing in for Gabriele Marcotti. This isn't going to be an esoteric question about European football. Is there any sign that Steven Gerrard, the Liverpool captain, is getting tired?
Well, there was no sign of it at Reading on Saturday at all. He was one of Liverpool's best players and visibly physically good and mentally going for it. What I find more interesting is the way he's being managed by Rodgers, who does seem to have, he doesn't seem to manage him as a manager, he manages him as a fan, as though he dare not drop him for a single minute of Premier League action, because goodness knows what would happen if he did. And I think that sense of over-reliance on Steven Gerrard, who will be 33 very soon, that doesn't bode well. He's a great player for Liverpool, but he probably needs managing better than Brendan Rodgers is prepared to do. That's it for this week. It has been fun. Thank you very much to my guests, George Culkin, Tony Cascarino and Rory Smith. Come and find us on Twitter and share your thoughts. Please, please do come and find us on Twitter. Or email gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. And you can go to thetimes.co.uk for news, views, web chats, blogs, analysis, and of course Twitter. Don't forget Twitter. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.